Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Joseph Ellis's new book, The Cause, The American Revolution and Its Discontents, 1773 to 1783, is an account of the origins and clashing ideologies of America's revolutionary era, recovering a war more brutal and more disorienting than any other in history, save perhaps the Civil War. Joseph Ellis is the best-selling author of 12 previous books, including American Sphinx, which won the National Book Award, and Founding Brothers, which won the Pulitzer Prize. Again, the new book is The Cause, The American Revolution and Its Discontents, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Joseph Ellis back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Mr. Donahue, it's my pleasure, and thanks for that nice introduction.
Thank you very much. This book is fascinating, and I believe it is so fascinating because of the time period that you chose. So give us an idea of why you wanted to look at that particular decade and ultimately, as the title suggests, the cause.
I started writing about the late 18th century about 30 years ago. I did a biography of John Adams and then of Thomas Jefferson, and I didn't know what I was doing. But what I was doing is attempting to write a history of what I call the American founding. The term isn't totally original with me, but the historians, and I am a card-carrying historian, tend to divvy up the past and even the 18th century into smaller increments. And I was trying to write the history of the movement from the American Revolution through the up to the Louisiana Purchase. And in a sense, though, the book that now is out is the first chronological book. It should have come first, but I couldn't write it then. The same way that a writer often doesn't write the preface of a book until he or she finishes, that's what I've done. And so The Cause is about the years from just before the outbreak of the Revolution, through the Revolution, until the end of the war and the signing of the treaty. The cause is a term I use because that's the term they used. Nobody called it the American Revolution until much later. The British called it the American Rebellion. The American colonists called it the Common Cause and then the Cause. Originally, the Common Cause meant the unity of all the colonies to support the colony of Massachusetts, which was being occupied by the British Army after the passage of something called the Coercive Acts to punish them for the Tea Party. The cause is a kind of canopy within which the various colonies, for different reasons, came together with a single purpose, to oppose what they call British tyranny. They don't agree about what they're for, but they know what they're against. They're against Great Britain, and they're for independence. I found myself, in the way of anybody writing from the 21st century, interested in certain things that I wouldn't have been interested in otherwise. Like, the whole war is fought during a pandemic, an outbreak of that kills 100,000 people of smallpox. And to give you another idea of the contemporary effect that things have, that one of the points of the book conclusions is that Great Britain had about as much chance of winning the American War for Independence as the United States had in winning in Vietnam or in Afghanistan. And they faced similar kind of problems. The war was very, very, they could win every battle, but they couldn't subjugate the entire population. And if you want to know why, we can talk about that. But the other thing that struck me is that our own visions of the war and of that generation during that time are shaped by artists like John Trumbull and Charles Wilson Peale and Gilbert Stuart, and it gives it a kind of romantic, iconic sheen. And that battle is kind of almost a matter of etiquette. That's well-tailored soldiers on the British side lined up in a perfect line, et cetera, et cetera. And the war was not the war. If there was a photographer available in the same way that there was for the Civil War, or if there was an artist like Goya, we wouldn't think of it the same way, but the War for American Independence was the bloodiest war in American history per capita, except for the Civil War. Battle was barbaric and face-to-face with bayonets and rifle butts. If you were a prisoner of war captured by the British, their chances of living were less than 50%. The British were more horrific in their treatment of American prisoners than the Japanese were in World War II. At the end, I think that when the war ends, the first sentence in the greatest speech in American history is historically incorrect. Lincoln in Gettysburg in 1863 says, 77 years ago, which was 76, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation. No, they didn't. They brought forth a confederation of sovereign states that were provisionally united to come together to win the war and then go their separate ways. And that's the way the war ended, and there's tragedy looming there. That's the reason the subtitle is "And Its Discontents," because in order to handle the two great potential tragedies, Indian removal and slavery, and putting slavery on the road to extinction, you needed to have a nation, and we didn't have one. All right, I've said enough. Has it prompted anything?
It's prompted many things. One of the things that you point out is about your cast of characters in the preface, and you say it's been assembled according to a modified version of the Casablanca Principle. So give us a sense of that cast of characters, and also the point that you make that you have given greater prominence to characters who customarily only get supporting roles.
Right, that's my little joke, and Casablanca Principle means we include George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton. Those are the biggies. Those are the prominent founders. You might want to throw John Marshall in there, too, and he's a captain in the Continental Army during this time. The cast of characters that I think deserve more attention than they've received and were perceived at the time as more significant and influential than we have made them later include Nathanael Greene, who is a general in the Continental Army. If Washington was killed, Washington said, "My successor should be Nathanael Greene." I think Nathanael Greene is viewed by most military historians and specialists as probably the most tactically brilliant military commander on the American side during the war, and his conduct of the campaign in the South is especially significant, bloody, and he's famous for saying that I'm going to lose my way to victory. That he suffers many casualties, but in the end thwarts any British occupation of the southern colonies. He's also married to this fascinating woman, who is another person that I think is worthy of more attention. Her name is Katie Greene, and Katie is the angel of Valley Forge, the woman who, wearing her nightgown, is moving from shed to shed, or those buildings they have at Valley Forge, singing songs, reading to dying men. She's really an incredible figure, and ends up settling in Savannah, Georgia, after her husband dies of sunstroke in 1786. If Nathanael Greene had lived, he would be the equivalent of a Hamilton again, I think. And by the way, she invites someone from Yale named the guy that invents the cotton gin. Down, and he invents the cotton gin on her plantation. But another guy is Robert Morris, who's the financier of the American Revolution, so-called, but he's been demonized as a kind of robber baron. And he's the guy who, when, say, Washington doesn't have the money to pay soldiers at the end of the war because the government's broke, he says, "I can't accept that." And so he writes $750 checks for every man in the army, and that's 12,000 of them. You can imagine. He's a fascinating character living in Philadelphia. Another, and I'll stop there, is John Jay. Jay's got a criminal justice college named after
right.
him, and but I think that he is probably the single most important person in terms of American foreign policy during the war. And at the Treaty of Paris, he's the one who insists that the western limit of America is the Mississippi, and nothing short of that. And that's the bold thing to say, because he's under orders not to say that. Jay's, there's many other places in the book where Jay appears, but he's an example of the kind of person who emerges out of nowhere as a 25, 26, 27-year-old guy in the course of the war. The war creates a crisis, and the crisis creates leadership, or gives it the opportunity to appear. And he's one of those people.
Of course, Eli Whitney, the inventor of the
Eli Whitney.
Chimney.
Thank you. I'm
yes.
getting old, and names are. I couldn't even remember the name of the shortstop of the Red Sox the other day, and I mean that's really bad, you know. And
for being such a fan.
Okay. Yeah, Whitney. Eli, by the way, Eli Whitney falls in love with Katie Greene, but you know, everybody falls in love with Katie Greene, but they don't get married.
Joseph Ellis is our guest on the roundtable this morning, winner of the Pulitzer Prize. His new book is The Cause, The American Revolution and Its Discontents, 1773 to 1783. The book is filled with profiles, too, throughout the story, and it's fascinating. There's one that I wanted to ask you about, William Billy Lee, who you refer to as the invisible man of the American Revolution.
Billy Lee is an African-American slave who was bought by Washington in 1768 because he was the only person who could keep up with him in a fox hunt. And Billy is his manservant throughout the war. He's there, you know, in from the beginning to the end. He's on the boats going across the river to Trenton and the Delaware. And he probably saves Washington's life at least once, maybe twice, and I wanted to feature him. He's the only slave that Washington frees outright in his will at the end of his life for his service. The war was not a war to end slavery, but it was a war based on principles that had an anti-slavery implication. And Billy was literate, and he could read the Declaration of Independence. He had to read it out loud, as a matter of fact, to some troops at one time. But there were other African-Americans, and I've got a profile of one of the others named Harry Washington, who's also a Washington slave, who sides with the British. About 20,000 slaves side with the British, about 20,000 leave. Most of them die of smallpox, or half of them. But 8,000 to 10,000 African-Americans served with the British Army, and about exactly the same number served with the Continental Army. And Billy's an example of the latter. And when I say he's the most famous, he's the invisible man. He's probably the most famous African-American of the time because he's Washington's servant, and everybody knows Billy. And in Valley Forge, "Hi, Billy, how you doing? How's the general doing?" Recovering Billy's personality as much as we can was one of my goals. You can never know what conversations are actually going on between Billy and Washington. But I think it's safe to say that Washington's own view of slavery evolved during the course of the war as he became aware of the fact that the war was fought on principles that were incompatible with slavery. And I think Billy was also an influence on his own thinking.
You write late in the book that neither an American nation nor a viable national government existed at the end of the war. All the political energy belonged to pluribus, not unum. Historians who talk about the looming emergence of a proverbial nation-state in post-war America are reading later developments into a revolutionary legacy that, in truth, regarded the creation of an American nation as the betrayal of the cause. How so?
Yeah, the majority of people, and prominent people, and ordinary Americans. You got to remember, an ordinary American at that time was born, lived out his or her life, and died within a 3-day horse ride. Their perspective was local, national, or continental. And there were thinkers like even Sam Adams and Richard Henry Lee are two of the ones who basically were arguing that the creation of any kind of robust federal government was going to create a domestic version of parliament. And we've been fighting a war to avoid that kind of tyranny, so that any federal government far removed from where you live was perceived as potentially dangerous. And there was a strong, very powerful and rooted in on the ground view that we can't have a federal government that tells us what to do in domestic or foreign policy. There were people, and Washington was the most prominent. Others were Franklin, Hamilton, who thought that the war had come to mean during the war, the cause had come to mean nationhood. But they were a very small minority. And at the end of the war, the term United States remained a plural noun. It's not the United States is, but the United States are. And it's going to take almost a kind of coup d'etat in 1787 to get the Constitution. But at the end of the war, we are like a League of Nations or like an early version of the EU. Nothing more consolidated or national than that.
When you look at the cause, and I'm assuming, even as you said, a card-carrying historian, that you learn a lot in putting a book like this together.
Yeah, I mean, you do. I mean, we, you know, historians can't claim to be objective. For that, you know, maybe mathematicians can claim that. We do claim to have as our ideal detachment, and that's a noble ideal, but it's unbelievable. But it is, in the end, we can never completely reach that goal. I think it's good to have the goal, but we're looking back to then from now, and now always is the present, and the present is always going to affect our thinking. And if we try to pretend it doesn't, we're fooling ourselves. But trying to be conscious of that and fair-minded about that, I don't think we want to go back. We do, as historians, want to be able to say that we have to recover the past on its own terms. And only after so doing can we make judgments, political judgments of our own. We don't want to be like the anthropologist who goes to Samoa and finds fault with the indigenous people of Samoa because they're not practicing the child-rearing precepts of Dr. Spock, who are going to London and criticizing the Londoners for speaking with a foreign accent. It is a different world back there. Distance had an enormous importance that it doesn't have now. As I used to have to tell my students, oh, by the way, they didn't have cell phones. And as I said before, the pandemic made me think about the role that smallpox played, the most important strategic decision that Washington made during the entire war was to vaccinate all his troops and require them to be quarantined for 2 weeks before they took present on the line. And our own experience in the Middle East of late is a way of understanding. You know, people would also, when I was on a tour for the Washington book, what would Washington do about Iraq? Well, he wouldn't know where Iraq was. But when they kept pressing me, I said, well, Washington would say, how do we get to be the British? And our own experience in wars where, as a newly arrived world power, brimming over with confidence, assured of our supremacy, both moral and economic and military, we step into quagmires. That's exactly what the British did in 1760s, we should have learned from it, but we didn't. On the other hand, I don't think you can go back and just apply your own politically correct values against the fixed objects of dead white males, and that's not fair. We have to be. When we look back at the past, as in nature, there's no straight lines. And in history, there's no straight political lines between our convictions and theirs. I do think, however, there's no question that the founders succeeded in incredible ways, and the first success was to win the first successful war for colonial independence in world history. Ask yourself how many wars the British lost between 1750 and 1950, and the answer is one. That was an achievement. The first nation-sized republic is a huge achievement. The first secular society, separation of church, huge achievement. But they failed to put slavery on the road to extinction, a huge failure. And the question is, to what extent is it a Shakespearean tragedy? That is, could it have gone the other way with the right leadership, or a Greek tragedy? It means it's embedded, no amount of leadership could change it. I think it was a Shakespearean tragedy. It could have gone the other way. But that's what we need to argue about.
Yeah, you even questioned the use of the word revolution, right?
Yes, it's what they called a prudent revolution, you know, and those two terms are not usually located together. And in some ways, the American Revolution succeeds because it defers the radical implications of its own values. Women's rights, elimination of the property requirement, the end of slavery, a just accommodation with the Native Americans. It defers that. Unlike the French Revolution, which attempts to implement its full agenda right away and then fails, the American Revolution succeeds, at least in winning independence, by deferring the full implications of that. Now, if you believe that justice delayed is justice denied, and that's a legitimate position, then you're going to say they should have attempted to implement the whole thing right away. And the problem with that is if they'd done that, they probably wouldn't have won the war because the South would have seceded. But that's, again, an argument we need to have. And instead of digging our heels and insisting on the rightness of our view, to engage in a dialogue, which is very difficult to have these days in the United States, Joe, as I think you probably know.
Absolutely. The name of the new book is The Cause, The American Revolution and Its Discontents by Joseph Ellis. A great pleasure to speak to you as always. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Be well. Thank you again. The name of Joseph Ellis's new book is The Cause, The American Revolution and Its Discontents, 1773 to 1783. It's published by Norton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.